And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Hannah Pittard to the program today. Hannah is the head of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Kentucky. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Oxford American, McSweeney's, and many others. She's the winner of the 2006 Amanda Davis High Wire Fiction Award. Her novels are Reunion, The Fates, Listen to Me, and today we'll talk about her fourth published novel, Visible Empire, available from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's the story of grieving, greed, and racial oppression in Atlanta in the aftermath of the Air France Flight 007, which crashed in Paris and killed over 100 of the richest Atlantans in the early 1960s. Hannah, when did you first hear of the Air France 007 crash of 1962?
Yeah, I can't pinpoint the exact time. I do know it was my mother. I know it was when I was still living in Atlanta. I was a little girl. I remember being terrified by this idea of a single airline accident that wiped out so many people from a single place. I remember being struck by it. It was the reason my mother was scared of flying herself. She was 13 when the crash happened. It is very likely the reason that I am scared of flying. You know, I think I inherited my fear from my mother. But if you think of transgenerational trauma, if she got it from the plane, in some ways I did as well.
So how do you overcome your distaste for flying right now?
Yeah. So there's a method. It involves Xanax, a prescribed medication, which keeps me just calm enough to be able to get on the plane and get off the plane. It doesn't really take away the unease, but it lets me get on and off. In my life, I have walked off a fair number of planes, and that was pre-medication. I've had flight attendants have to pull the wallet out of my back pocket because my hands just stopped working. It's as close to panic attacks as I've ever come, but medication does the trick, and I'm even sometimes able to enjoy the views when I get way up there. I never like takeoff.
In writing Visible Empire, did it get worse?
It didn't get worse. Here was one of the benefits of writing about this incident. I spoke to the guy who is formerly Ask a Pilot. He wrote the article called Ask a Pilot, and he just sounded so reasonable and calm about flying and about how safe it is. You know, I'd read his articles and I've read the statistics that it's safer than driving. I believe them. You know, I think of myself as a pretty aggressive and safe driver, but I understand that fear is not rational, which is one of the reasons I think it's so powerful. But the best part was talking to him. He made me feel confident in it. I understand that when there's turbulence, that's a good thing. The plane is supposed to be responding to the air outside in that way. We wouldn't want the plane to encounter rough air and not move about. So it didn't get worse, but it also didn't vanish.
Why did you choose to use this actual event of 62 instead of creating one of your own?
This event happened in 1962, and that held a lot of appeal to me as a time period. I liked it because it was Atlanta. I liked it because it was 62 and not 68 or 69. It was interesting to me that it was at the beginning of the cultural, racial, and sexual revolutions and not full swing into it. And that provided me sort of with the ingredients that I was interested in looking at. I was interested in exploring a city on the brink of great change, in part because I think that we are right now a country in the midst of great change. And even though I was writing a story about 1962, I really do think that, for me at least, the process was trying to work through some of the things that I feel like I'm experiencing and that I see other people experiencing in the news on a daily basis in this world and this time period right now.
You'd mentioned that it was people from one place, but more so it was people from one community that were involved in this crash.
Yeah, this was another thing that appealed to me. This was an all-white, very elite group of people, very tight-knit. in Atlanta. And when these Atlantans died, the world took notice. France sent a Rodin. They sent us Whistler's mother to be on display in honor of these people who had died. And the mayor of Atlanta at the time, Ivan Allen, who had only recently taken office, he referred to the incident as Atlanta's greatest tragedy. And all of this seemed to me a sort of ripe landscape to explore because of its fundamental myopia, for lack of a better word. This flight absolutely was a tragedy, but it was by no means Atlanta's greatest tragedy. Atlanta's greatest tragedy is its history of legalized racism and its treatment of African Americans. And at the same time that you had Ivan Allen calling it the city's greatest tragedy, you also had Malcolm X on the other side of the country in California at the Ronald Stokes protest in LA calling it the work of God and essentially calling on God to do it again.
And you use in your epigraph the quote from Malcolm X on that. And it's really hard to condemn him for his lack of humanity, given everything African Americans had suffered up to that point and still do.
Oh, I absolutely agree. No, I
didn't think you were condemning him.
No,
but,
no.
But it is harsh. But,
it is harsh. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, just after the speech at this protest/rally that Malcolm X delivered, you know, MLK came out and disavowed what Malcolm X had said. He fervently disagreed with that. And in fact, on the other side, you know, back on the east side of the country, Martin Luther King canceled a sit-in/protest that was in honor or in protest of Harry Belafonte having been denied service at an all-white restaurant in Atlanta. So you had two very radical ways of viewing this incident from African-American leaders. And that's also one of the reasons that in the epigraphs, what Malcolm X says is situated after what Ivan Allen says. I want the readers to encounter those epigraphs very deliberately. There are four epigraphs. The first one states a fact. At the time, this was, in the history of aviation, the deadliest disaster involving a single airplane. The second one is a declaration. It's Ivan Allen. This is Atlanta's greatest tragedy. It's an opinion. The third one is, it's an invocation in certain ways. It is Malcolm X saying, this is the work of God, and we call on God to do it again. And then the fourth one, which, again, is very deliberately there at the end, and it's the thing that I want readers to encounter before they begin the book, is an anonymous relative who's lost two people in the crash, and to the New York Times, he is quoted as saying something along the lines of, this thing is so overwhelming, I can't feel anything. Perhaps it will hit me tomorrow. I'm so moved by how straightforward that is. In my mind, it is a perfect distillation of the ways in which I've encountered grief personally, this sort of hellish purgatory where you're waiting for the inevitable to kick in. You know the person is gone. You can't feel it. You don't want to feel it, but you know it's going to happen. And the book, while it begins with a crash, is not really about a crash. It's about the aftermath of a crash, and it is about the way that different people from different backgrounds navigate grief. And that's why those epigraphs are in the order that they're presented in.
As you mentioned, Ivan Allen Jr. had just recently taken office in Atlanta, and he was relatively progressive for his time, especially since his opponent in the election was Lester Maddox.
Right. Ivan Allen is a really interesting character in my mind, and he is the one true-to-life character, and I put true-to-life in quotation marks because I have appropriated his legacy in some ways for this book. He is the comparison that I make, which is not to say that I am anything like Philip Roth, who is an idol of mine, but it's the equivalent of Philip Roth appropriating Lindbergh as president. So I have appropriated the idea of Ivan Allen for this book in order to be able to introduce certain historical elements, things that have occurred like the Harry Belafonte issue. But Ivan Allen was really interesting to research because he started off as a moderate liberal. The majority of his friends were not. They were good old Southern boys. But he was a moderate liberal, and he became increasingly progressive over the course of his, it's not reign, it's not rule.
Terms.
Thank you, term. He's not a king. So he became increasingly progressive over the course of his term. But what was interesting to me as I was researching him was the fact that he was motivated by economics and by practicality. He was not motivated, especially at the beginning of his career as a politician. I think it changed towards the end, but at the beginning, he was not motivated by the support of the decency of mankind and the liberation and respect of the African American people. He was very much about what's good for my city. This is good for my city. Integration is good for my city. Then let's integrate. But he made mistakes along the way.
The fence.
Yeah, the fence. That's exactly what I was going to talk about. He actually allowed a wall to be built between a white community and a black community in order for that white community to, you know, quote unquote, protect itself. And the wall, which never was completed, by the time the wall was ruled unconstitutional, by the accounts that I've read, Ivan Allen was relieved that it was coming down because he realized just what a mess that had been to support that.
He and his wife, Lulu, have very brief chapters throughout the book, and it reminded me a bit of like maybe like Greek gods commenting on the action of a play back in Sophocles' time or something like that.
Well, thank you, because I love Sophocles, and I went to St. John's College, and so the
Great Books program.
Yes, I did the Great Books program, and this, they very much, in my mind, are a chorus, and they're meant to be the individuals who, in some ways, represent two drastically opposed ways in which the city and people in the city might be responding to this catastrophe. You have Lulu on the one hand, who is nothing but heart and emotion, and her heart is on her sleeve. And Ivan Allen is, because he is tasked with the job of moving the city forward and through this, and he sees this as the thing that, I mean, this is within 6 months of taking office, he is dealing with this. So he's very much trying to be the stalwart leader that the world is watching. And so they became the vehicle for me through which to look at a couple, to look at the city, to look at the way that grief affects even people who are very close differently.
Kindness, did you try to pay them because they're historical personages and not created characters?
Absolutely. That's a nice way of putting it. What kindness? Because I did. The few characters who are in here, either who are loosely based on real people or whose names I have taken, I really did try to pay them a kindness. Lulu, I think at times by her husband, and what I have done to their relationship is 100% fictitious. If there is any overlap, it is accident. But Lulu at times by her husband is regarded as nearly, I think, mad and off kilter, and to use a phrase of that era, hysterical. And I see Lulu as the person who is dealing with the pain of this incident, because to her, they were 121 of her closest friends. I see her as dealing with this incident in the honest and appropriate way. She, in my mind, is not hysterical. She is absolutely being honest to herself and to her emotions. And that is the kindness that I have paid her. And with regard to Ivan Allen, you know, I use his character. I think it's really important in books and in stories that we see reversals. And what I hoped for him was to find a path towards a reversal, which comes late in the book. And Lulu seems to be expecting and expecting and expecting it. And, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but when it finally comes, she's there and she's ready for it. And I think I bring them closer together than they ever were before.
There is a white couple kind of at the nexus of things, Lily and Robert Tucker. She has lost her parents in the crash.
Lily is like, what's the joke about a country song? If you play it backwards, you get your wife back, your dog back, and your job back. Lily is a country song played forward. I take everything away from her at the beginning of the book. She is, by all rights, beautiful, She is well-heeled. She is from a prominent family. She is living a life of complete privilege and luxury. And on the day of the crash, she loses both her parents, her husband, who has lost his mistress to the crash, leaves her, informs her of the infidelity, leaves her, and then within several days, Lily finds out that her parents, who she loved so well and who doted on her, they have not only spent their own fortune, but they have spent the last several years of their lives before dying spending her fortune as well. So she's left penniless, she's left parentless, she's left without a husband, and she's 7 months pregnant. They are at the heart of the novel very much. And even before I knew many of the plot lines, because it is an ensemble cast and it's not simply meant to be their story. And I think there are some characters who have less screen time who in many ways take over the story, and I'm really glad that they do. But even before I knew too much about those other characters, I did know that I wanted to write a book in which the couple at the beginning separate and they spend the entirety of the book apart, going through their own experiences and becoming different types of people who, if and when they reunite at the end, reunite as different people, better people, and have the possibility of potentially a better relationship.
And it seems so many of the people who suffer losses from the crash, the financial aspect is almost equal, if not more important, than the personal loss.
The ones who I have chosen to write about certainly do seem to be more interested either in money, what's been left to them or what hasn't been left to them, or the performance of grief. And again, I don't want to suggest that that is what the majority of us do when we encounter grief, but certainly for the sake of fiction and entertainment, those types were the ones who were more compelling for me to follow, and their trajectories were more interesting. And I tried to be kind to them too. Even the lowest of the low in the book, I have tried to account for what might make them the ne'er-do-wells that they are.
Now, Robert Tucker is an editor at the Atlanta Journal newspaper, and he's a self-made man except for the luxury he lives in, which is provided by his in-laws. But he's trying his best to become a self-destroyed man at this point.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. He is. He finds out that his mistress has died. And by the way, his wife, Lily, is beautiful and 24, far too young for him. He's in his 40s. And his mistress is beautiful and 23, far too young for him as well. So when he finds out that his mistress has died, he, rather than use it as an excuse to start over and be a better man, be a better husband, he uses it as an excuse to completely engage in the act of self-destruction and self-pity.
He had coerced Rita, his mistress, to take the trip. I mean, he really had to twist her arm to take that trip.
He did. And so there's certainly, I think, an element of guilt that is motivating him. He wants to punish himself. He doesn't want to be forgiven by his wife. He doesn't think he deserves her. And in many ways, I think that he believes he's responsible for a different young woman's death.
Now, there is a couple in the book who took separate flights because they didn't want to have their children's futures depend on one airplane. Was there a case like that in the real crash?
There was a case like that in the real crash, and it was a couple who was famous for, within the circle of Atlanta and their community, for flying separately. And they did this because they had three small children at home who they adored, and it was a superstition that they tolerated and perhaps even revered in order to protect their children. And I did not use the names of that family, but I did make sure that of all the people that I portray in the book, the man who watches his wife and his mother-in-law die in the crash because he's going to take a flight 6 hours later and not the chartered flight back to Atlanta, in my opinion, he is the most upstanding and decent human being in that book. And I have done that deliberately. I want him to be a beacon of hope and kindness and generosity. And he functions that way for the book, and he functions that way also for Robert. He is the sort of epiphany that Robert is working towards.
And he seems so eminently decent in all of his actions that until just now when we were speaking, I was going, yeah, he's got to have a flaw. Then I just started thinking about, well, where did his family get their money?
Exactly. And that's another conversation. And who knows with regard to the real family, but that's another conversation that comes up at some point in the book between two minor characters. There's one man who is going to buy a small airplane from another man. Both these men have had parents who died in the crash. It's that kind of town. It's that small a community. And the fellow who's purchasing the plane has it in his mind that because his father died in the crash, he is now invincible. And the man who's selling his small airplane has it in his mind, because his father has died in the crash, he will likely die in his own crash. You know, they take their superstitions in two very different ways. But there's a conversation that occurs between the two of them very late at night where the fellow buying the airplane makes a suggestion that his family's money is better than the other family's money, because the other family's money comes from, the suggestion is, slavery. And the man who is being accused of having slavery in his past says something along the lines of, it's all going into the same bank. You can say you're Coca-Cola and you can tell me mine's cotton, but it's all going into the same bank. It's all fungible. The crimes are still there in our past. And so I'm hoping that, you know, I think good literature asks or inspires readers to ask good questions. And I hope that that conversation raises some questions about past and responsibility and history and the idea of fungibility when it comes to our sins.
And there is a callousness in the character P.T. Coleman. And to call him louche would be kind of an understatement.
P.T. Coleman, you know, he is definitely, he's the opposite of the decent man whose wife and mother-in-law die on the plane. He is meant to be a foil to him. And he helps guide Robert on his descent into self-pity and total self-indulgence. But even P.T. Coleman, I intentionally gave a very small chapter of his own. And in that chapter, we see him being every bit the scoundrel that he is. But there's also a very tiny origin story there to offer a possible explanation for why he might be the person that he is today. And it's just a little hint at childhood abuse and neglect and a mother and a father who didn't protect him that might have allowed him to become the kind of individual he is today. You know, I very much, as a writer, have tried, especially in the last 10, 15 years, you know, post-grad school, I've tried to be a writer who looks up at the world instead of down at the world. And part of that has come out of teaching and teaching young people. I love, there's a class that I teach, it's 150 freshmen. And it's really important to me that I'm teaching them not only to remember that they love reading and to show them the beauty of books, but I'm also trying to show them empathy and what it means to care about other people and to try to imagine the point of view of other people, what it might be to be someone else. I think creative writing can do that, and teaching creative writing, that we can do that. We can promote and teach empathy. And so even with these scoundrel characters, something that I'm always trying to tell my students is, for us to want to be interested, you've got to make that character love something. Everybody loves something, whether or not it's inappropriate. You know, if you've got a serial killer, give him a dog. Give him a dog that he takes really good care of. And that's interesting. I think it gets at the heart of what William Faulkner talks about in his Nobel acceptance, the human heart in conflict with itself, which is something that at the end of the day, I am very, very interested in as a writer, the human heart in conflict with itself. So hopefully P.T. Coleman, though he does appear to be 98% bad, there is that 2% of something, not decency, but, you know, a flicker, a glimmer of innocence somewhere back down there in his dark soul.
Well, and we can see how grief and regret plays out for so many of the characters in the course of this. But then that's on a personal scale. And when we think about the more societal scale, that grief and regret doesn't ever come to bear, and it just comes out as defensiveness and hostility.
I think that's right. And that's one of the reasons that I include a fairly hypocritical, difficult scene towards the end. There's a big party. It happens every year. Lulu, again, the mayor's wife, finds out that the party is going to happen. It happens on the 4th of July, so it's going to occur a month after the crash, and she can't believe it. She's incensed that the party is happening, and what she's thinking about is this city should still be in grieving. This city should still be thinking about the people who have been left behind. Meanwhile, there's another side of this party that she's not thinking of, the house where the event takes place. And I'm talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people go to this party. And the event where this freedom party, this celebration of freedom, which is what it is, except they're not really thinking of freedom. They're thinking of booze and decadence and firecrackers all day long. But I have made this location a place where a tree once stood where an entire family had been lynched. And towards the end of the book, there are characters who show up. There are three characters who show up, and they are African-American, and they're incensed by the hypocrisy of these white people celebrating this day of quote-unquote freedom while not looking at the thing that's right in front of them, which is a very repressed people and legalized racism, which I think also gets back to the heart of the title. You know, the full name of the KKK is the Invisible Empire of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And with this title, Visible Empire, I wanted to question the idea of power that we can see. By my reading of Invisible Empire of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, it's hinting at power that is dangerous and potent because of its invisibility. I want to talk about power that might be dangerous even when we can see it, because sometimes when we see it, we think that we don't need to discuss it. It's so ingrained in our way of life and thinking.
We meet another character early on, Piedmont Dobbs. He's an African-American teenager, and he's leaving home. Why is that?
So in doing the research for this book, there's a great book of nonfiction by Ann Abrams called Explosion at Worley, which really informed my early research and just was a wonderful, you know, diving board for me to start looking at a lot of other sources. But in it, she talked about the situation with education in Atlanta. In 1960, we were still segregated. Obviously, Brown versus Board of Education had occurred in 1954, so we needed to begin integration. In 1961, the mayor at the time, Hartsfield, created a commission to go around, talk to prominent leaders around the town, and decide one of two things: dismantle the public schools all together in Atlanta, or begin integration. And that was an actual conversation. There was the possibility that Atlanta was going to be so resistant to the idea of following through on Brown versus Board of Education that they were actually considering eliminating public schools. Fortunately, that didn't happen. The panels came back largely in favor of integration. And so in 1961, integration began. Of course, it's Atlanta. It's 1961. There is not a very eager delegate that is saying, let's move quickly forward into the future. So the idea as a way to integrate as slowly as possible, follow the rules as slowly as possible, they decided to integrate only 12th grade. So in 1961, there was a call for applications. I encountered it for the first time, this information, in that Ann Abrams book. But there was a call for applications 132 African Americans, juniors, applied to be among the first 10, because they were going to choose 10, first 10 African Americans to begin integrating the public school system in Atlanta. Ultimately, they chose 10 and not only 9 matriculated into the senior year. And when I read that, I thought, well, that would just be a fascinating way to begin to look at the idea and the role of race in this time. I knew that I had to account for race. I knew the minute I saw that Malcolm X quote in which he calls the crash the work of God, that it would be irresponsible to write a story about Atlanta in that time and not try to tackle the issue of race. And when I encountered that statistic, I thought 10 students out of 132 were chosen. And I just couldn't stop thinking about what it must have been to be one of the kids who applied and didn't get chosen. And from that nonstop imagination, Piedmont Dobbs was born. You know, he's very close to my heart as a character. He is one of the people who I think takes over the story in many ways, more so even than Lillian Robert, because I think he is quintessentially, getting back to Faulkner, that human heart in conflict with itself. He suffered this terrible disappointment by not being chosen to integrate the school system. He leaves home out of embarrassment. He drops out of school out of pride. When we meet him on the day of the crash, he's been away from his mother's home for almost a year, out of touch with her for almost a year, and he's mopping the floors at a bar, a white establishment, and he sees on this grainy black and white television, he sees the news of the crash. The white men in the bar stand up and leave. And his very first thought, because he's so angry and he's so devastated by his own personal devastation, his very first thought is, the city had it coming. And he spends the rest of the book, and we spend the rest of our storyline with him as he tries to figure out what it means to have that instinct and that thought, and whether he is that person who really thinks that, or if he can become a different type of person. And he's 19. He feels like a kid. He feels like a grown-up. You know, he's very much between these two worlds. He's shown extreme and possibly unrealistic kindness by a white woman, and even that he struggles with. He is moved by the kindness. He is fearful that the kindness is pity, which he doesn't want. But his is a real personal journey, trying to figure out who he is and what it means to have had that thought at the beginning of the book.
Now, I was thinking in the course of the book that there's the legislated privilege that the white community enjoys in this time, and that that is an official way of damaging the black community. But even in that white woman's attempt to be kind to Piedmont, that she doesn't see the inherent danger, her kindness to him, that can also damage him as well.
And I think we, especially towards the end of Lily's storyline, we begin to see her have more awareness of the way that her generosity potentially impairs or puts Piedmont in danger. But really, she is a work of privilege. I mean, she has been privileged her entire life, and she is struggling, back to the idea of instinct. Her instinct is the privileged position and point of view, and she is really working hard by the end to not have that privileged point of view, to begin to try to see it, but it's very difficult for her. And I think, again, I don't want to give away the end, but the end is meant to show how it's not the equivalent of The Sun Also Rises, but it's not far from What a Pretty Thought. She allows herself this fantasy of what might be. I know I'm speaking in abstractions, so you have to buy the book in order to understand what we're saying. But she allows herself this fantasy, and obviously the fantasy is undercut because of its just absolute impossibility.
Allow me to give away my favorite line of the book.
Please.
Robert is talking to someone who is very wealthy. And Robert, since he was a self-made white man, he falls somewhere on the middle of the scale when it comes to privilege. He can see the absolute privilege of wealth, but he still can't quite see the privilege of his skin color. But he says to a character, "You have money. It's your responsibility to find value elsewhere."
I'm so glad you like that line.
Well, it's just I just thought that was fabulous, and in our times, it's still appropriate.
I think it is too. I am hopeful that on the one hand, this book provides some amount of respite from the news today and the craziness of the news today. On the other hand, I hope that, you know, if one or two readers begins to look at the world differently or decides to be kind in a way they weren't expecting to be kind that day, I'll say that I've done my job and be pretty happy.
Now, we also meet another point of view character, Stacy, who goes by the name Anastasia. And she's white, but not from upper class either. But it turns out she's adopted a very apropos name.
It's true. So Anastasia Rivers, she is a character who I have been thinking of for a long time, the sort of outline of this character who takes advantage of other people's grief. She takes advantage of this really bad situation, this terrible incident, and she uses it as a stepping stone to promote her own visibility. And I've been thinking of her in part, I think before this as well, but in part since 9/11 and since we started hearing stories slowly over the years that followed about people who claimed to have been in the towers.
Oh, that comedian who had claimed, yeah,
that, I remember that. And he wasn't even in the same state. And there have been others. And I've been thinking a lot about people like that and people who want to be close to tragedy because rather than seeing the absolute devastation of it or the heartache of it, they see opportunity. And I think people who, when bad things happen to other people, when they see an opportunity, when they see that as potentially alluring or sexy, those are people who are missing their own genuine experiences with tragedy and devastation. Because I think once you've lost somebody, once you've really known what it is to have a person or people go missing from your life, I suspect strongly that you no longer crave that proximity to grief. But Anastasia is a person who, because she lacks depth, is looking for meaning anywhere. And she's also looking for opportunity anywhere. And she discovers it, very fortunately, in a woman whose brother has died in the plane crash. And Anastasia sees this woman as very, very vulnerable. And she's drawn to the vulnerability, not because she truly wants to provide for this woman, but because she thinks that she can exploit it. And what happens to Anastasia is pretty priceless.
Well, she doesn't understand that the rich aren't like you and me.
No, she doesn't. She doesn't. And even when she thinks she... I love Anastasia so much because every time she thinks she's come across an epiphany or an awakening or has some better understanding of the world, there is a new epiphany or understanding waiting for her just around the corner that she just cannot anticipate. For as aware as she wants to be, she misses a lot.
As she has a pair of blinders on, and one of them is named naivete and the other one is named callowness.
Absolutely. That's nice.
Now, in the book, there are people who are marginalized in society, and their actions to act out are considered to be illegal. But those who aren't marginalized, their poor behavior is legislated and approved of.
That's right.
Sorry, I didn't have a question. It's just so often you can see one character is trying to take advantage of another family member because of the tragedy and that he's going through legal means to inflict this evil on his relative.
I won't say that wasn't intentional. It was. You know, I keep talking about legalized racism. Obviously, I'm from Atlanta. This is a part of my history as well. I was fortunately born after it, but the effects of it were still there in my youth, are still there now. And I did want to, and frankly, I'm really grateful that you picked up on, we're talking now about Coleman again. Coleman is following very legal means to enact great cruelties on family members, and he is doing what is within his right to do. I do think that he gets his comeuppance in different ways. But at the same time, there are people who are simply trying to help other people. I'm thinking of Piedmont here at the very end of the book, his final chapter. He makes a tremendous sacrifice, and he does something that is a great act of courage in an attempt to help a white woman, and he's repaid with just, I think, the grossest response possible from other white people.
And going back to the kind of the cultural impact of the crash itself, one of the newspapers covering that was immortalized by Andy Warhol in a painting.
That's
amazing,
right?
How important this thing was culturally.
Warhol's painting, 129 Die in Jet, that was the beginning of a series of paintings that he did. I've heard them referred to differently as his death paintings, his devastation paintings. But from that incident, an entire work of art in the same vein came from him. It was something that everyone was paying attention to because of the scope, because it was Atlanta, and I think not LA or Chicago or New York, and the world suddenly was watching us, and it was because of the death of 100 plus white citizens, which again was part of what made me want to tackle this time period. Obviously, the country had been paying attention on and off to the South. There were certainly things going on. For instance, Martin Luther King spends a night in jail, and in 1961, and because of that, and because of phone calls that JFK made in order to get him out of prison, African Americans showed up to the polls that year in incredible numbers. And there are some historians who attribute the election of JFK to that event. So clearly, you know, the country was aware of Atlanta. The country was aware of what was happening in the South. But it took the death of 120 people for the world to look at Atlanta. And even then, they were looking at a very particular subset at the top.
In the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, there's like 15 or 20 of those newspaper paintings that he did up on one wall.
They're so stunning. They're so stark. And that original one, the 129 Die in Jet, it is the image of the burnt wing from the crash itself that was on the front cover of all of the papers. And it's a really bleak but provocative and just instantly unforgettable image.
Now, have you heard from the people of Atlanta and how they feel about this book?
My very first stop was in Atlanta on June 5th, on the day the book came out, and the Margaret Mitchell House hosted me. It was a really nice turnout. There were about 100 people there. We sold out of books, which is always nice for the publisher. But
it's kind of an irony being in the Margaret Mitchell House.
I know. There are all sorts of ironies at work. But the people of Atlanta who showed up were very welcoming. We had a really nice conversation. I didn't do a reading. I read aloud the epigraphs, and then I talked about how those four quotations really affected the method with which I approached writing this book and the things that were foremost in my mind as I was thinking about the storylines. I would anticipate, in the way I have with every single book I've written or will write, that not everyone will be happy with this book. I've been very grateful so far for the kind words that I've received and for the lovely reception that I was given in Atlanta. But no, I'm sure that people will be unhappy with it. And I'm sure that there are people who are unhappy with novels that talk about 9/11. And there must be some amount of pushback or anger in certain places about me writing about an incident that didn't specifically impact me, but it's art, and I will keep making art. And if I ever have to write only about what I know, then that's the day that I'm probably going to hang up my pen and call it a day, because I always come back to the idea of the beauty of fiction is the way that it promotes empathy, and it promotes empathy because it is providing doorways and windows into seeing how other people might live or think or love. And that only makes us bigger, better, more open, and less myopic people.
At the beginning of the interview, we talked a lot about the historicity of the concept of the book. Are you frustrated when people concentrate more on the history than on the contents of the novel?
Frustrated is a really interesting word, because I do think that the more books I write, the better I get at not being frustrated. I have learned, I'm the youngest child, I've taught myself techniques for dealing with pain, both emotional and physical, that is sometimes inflicted on me. But I would say that I am learning to be amused, or I'm still trying to go towards amusement as a reaction over frustration or anger. But obviously, instincts are instincts. And sometimes, yes, I get a little bit perturbed when I hear, for instance, of somebody who says that this book isn't about the crash. You know, where was the crash? I wanted more violence. This isn't about a plane crash at all. And well, that's right. It's not a book about the plane crash. This is very much, and intentionally so, a book about the aftermath of extreme loss and the ways that individuals and communities can or can't come back together, because that is what is interesting to me, and that's what I'm seeing in the world around me. The last 4, 5, 6 years, the number of school shootings has devastated me, not only because I'm a teacher, but because I am a human being. And one of the things that I was doing with this book was, for me, it was personal. I write to make sense of the world around me. I write to make sense of the things that terrify me and confuse me. These school shootings, church shootings, they terrify me. They confuse me. I am trying to sort through my own very personal reactions to these instances, and watching communities, watching them at a remove, at the safety of a television, the safety of newspapers, watching their stories as they learn to reunite, reconnect, and navigate what is for them the new normal. It's a loss that they haven't anticipated. So this is not a book about the plane crash. This is a book about what happens afterwards, after a community has lost a great, great deal of people. And there's obviously a chapter where the crash is explained. I did quite a bit of research. I do think that was necessary. It was an unsettling chapter to write. It's an unsettling story, but certainly there is frustration, but I try not to dwell on that. I always, as a writer, and most of the writers who I know try to do something similar, I like to have another project that I'm working on when the reviews start coming out and when the interviews start happening. There is this baby, Visible Empire, but there is another baby underway, and I think that helps keep me sane at any rate.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on a novel.
Right. Well, and I was looking at your publishing history, and that together with being an academic and working at the University of Kentucky, that you've published really regularly, and it's like almost like Richard Bausch, who is an academic, and he publishes very regularly as well. I mean, how do you think you and he can handle that, and other people seem to, when they're in the college atmosphere, tend to spread out 4 or 5 years between books?
I guess one of the things I would say is 4 or 5 years between books, that's not bad, right? That's not bad either. 10 years between books is certainly not bad. It's great. In fact, look at Donna Tartt. She takes her time, and for good reason, and I don't think anyone's going to fault her for it. I think that there's a certain amount of drive that I don't think it's lacking in other writers who take longer. I have a really unusual work ethic. I also don't work all the time with when I write. I take months off. I can be a really terrible person to be around, because I can also spend months where that's all I'm doing is writing. I don't have children. It's a decision that I made. I think that probably offers me more free time. I don't know. I often worry too that I'll hit a wall. In addition to writing and being a teacher, I'm also a runner, and I'm very familiar with, you know, hitting the wall at mile 22 in a marathon. And there is a part of me that often thinks, this is the last one, this will be the last one, and then a few months will go by and I cannot wait to start writing again. But I wouldn't presume to know why I write as much as I do. I mean, there are, for the 4 books that I've published, there are 3 full manuscripts that did not get published, that editors saw and did not want. I think that I might have a little bit of what Joyce Carol Oates has. I don't sleep a lot. Frankly, I'd rather write less and have fewer publications if in the next 10 years and sleep better. That's a trade I'd happily make. But I think I've been lucky, and I think I work really hard. I think I've been lucky. It's a combination of a couple of things, being where I am. I think it's a combination of ambition. It's a combination of that and luck and hard work and sometimes being in the right place at the right time. I do not think I am blessed, and I do not think it is 100%. This is just something I've really worked towards and I've earned it. I think there's a lot of luck involved.
I just saw a tweet this morning. I can't remember the author, but someone had taken a picture of the dedication page, and the author had thanked his partner and then thanked his 2 young children and said, without whom this book would have come out 2 years earlier.
The question of children, it's a hot topic in the literary world, and it's one that I don't feel like taking a stance on. It seems to be the thing that people are discussing in the way that a few years ago it was New York City versus the MFA, which also just seems like something that those conversations just take up time. We could all just be reading or being outside, being kind to one another, or being inside writing.
Well, Hannah, I want to thank you so much for coming by today and spending a little time with us. It's been very much a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me. It was an honor to be here.
Hannah Pittard is the author of Visible Empire, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work, but there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.